This is Frank Zimmerman, and I'm with Ken Todd. The date is November 26th of 2019, and we are here at the Evergreen Retirement Center in Normal, Illinois. I want to thank Ken for his time today and sharing his story. This recording will be accessioned into the oral history collection at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where it can be accessed in future by researchers and those interested in the history of Alaska and the people who contributed to that history. We'll start off first, Ken, with some personal and background information. Can you tell me where you were born and a bit about your family?
I was born on a farm between Danvers, Illinois, and Carlock, Illinois.
And what was the date in your tent?
That date was March the 30th, 1928. All of my, from a family of children. My mother had nine children. I, being in the middle, had four girls ahead of me, and I was in the middle, and then four boys and girls after me. However, at the time of my birth, my aunt, my mother's sister, was 10 years younger, was a nurse, and we had two of them there. And they determined they was over their head. They needed help. So my dad got his old Ford Model T, I think it was, out. And this was in March. It had snowed the day before. There was 12 inches of snow on the ground. And on the way in, it was, I think, 11 miles into the hospital. The car got stuck. My dad walked back to the house, hitched up a team of horses with the bed, and put some beds on it, and come back and drove us to the hospital. It was a very hard birth, and I suffered consequences unbeknownst to me for my 24th year of life. I did not know how bad that was, but it was very bad. How that happened is another long story, but that started my whole life up.
What did your father and mother do for a living?
They were farmers. Had cows, horses, corn, typical farmer. Had a lot of kids to help with the farm. And this went on through my life, till I reached a rather old age, I would say, for me at that time, which is 17 years of age. I had gone through school, primary school, and high school, which was in the country, had one classroom, one building, and a teacher. And I went from, started school when I was about the age of five, and went up through high school, which ended at 17. At this time, it was in the World War II, and I had received a notice of that I was going to be drafted very soon, but it would have been on my 18th birthday. But prior to that, I had an option. I could pick my line of service: Army, Air Force, Navy. At the time of my at birth, at that time, I would have probably been sent into the Army. So I volunteered. I had to serve 1 year longer. So I volunteered in the airport at age 17. And my mother had to sign for me to do that, because I wasn't an adult. And so that started in my whole life when I entered the service. And it was in the Air Force. I actually have the actual fighting in the Air Force in 1946, but the war had not declared to be ended. And it didn't end until in March of 1946, I then enlisted at the time of my birthday, which was in March, and the war was still going on, but it was technically over. And Harry Truman, at the time, who was our national man, then declared war in December 1942. And that gave me the right to be a member of World War II for that period of time. So after that, I went through the normal training period, of course, involved airplanes. I had not had an education at that time to become a pilot. You had to have either a college degree or another degree involving things. But I got into the airplane business, and I was trained. It took a year to be a flight engineer, which is the guy who actually runs the airplane. And entered the Korean War at this time. I was at this time 21 years of age. It was in 1951 that this happened. I'd finished my training and everything. And then we had a bomber crew of 10 people. It was a B-29, a huge airplane at that time. Weighed 160 tons. Had 35,000 gallons of fuel. Carried 4,500-pound bombs. We had a crew of 10, as I said before, co-pilot, an engineer, navigator, radio operator, bombardier, myself, the engineer, and three gunners who ran the guns because we were attacked in flight by enemy fighters at the time. I went through that. My third flight, it was a night flight. On night flights, we carried 39 500-pound bombs and a photo flash. On day flights, we carried 4,500-pound bombs up. And as we entered the target area, the flak was heavy, and we were hit by flak. And they hit on the number one engine, killed it dead, and was on fire. We had to drop our bombs to try and get out of the flight area, somewhere where we could salvage our mission. We did that. I finally got the fire put out on that engine, but could not feather the prop, which was a terrible thing because the pilot at the time was saying, "Engineer, I can't fly the airplane. It was something that I was never trained for this to happen. But here it was, I did. And I did the best thing I could do. I called my phone. That meant of all these 10 people, I was talking on the phone. No one could interrupt. I called for the West, the left waist gunner who could see the airplane and the back. I could not see it. I was in the opposite side of the airplane. And I asked him that the prop was going in and out being feathered for flight. And the pilot, you could imagine, he was going crazy. He couldn't control his thing. And in desperation, I asked the waist gunner, I said, "You tell me when the prop goes in the feather, just before that, and starts to turn around and go out of feather, you just say now." And this did happen. I crashed the electrical system on that wing for everything, because the pump that feathered this prop was electrical, and that did the job. The prop was feathered, I was cleaning up the mess after that. The pilot's happy now. He can control the airplane. But the engine was still on fire. That was the easy thing. I closed it up, was a turn back then from the outside, and set off a fire extinguisher. Good. The engine stopped burning. And we can all settle back and rest for a little while. And all of a sudden, the waist gunner again calls me on the phone, and he says, "Look at the number 2 engine, the air, which had been running well and producing good torque for me." And I got in a position. I got out of my seat and walked on the other side and looked at it, and it was leaking oil. He saw it was running back over the wing. Now we've got a major problem. We got problems with one engine that's dead on the left side, another engine that we don't know about. And that's a bad thing to do in an air 4-engine airplane. You could have 2 engines out, would be not a big problem. But if they're both on the same side, that was a big problem. So, but the engine was still running and giving me good torque. And the gunner back car called at this time. He had called that there was oil leaking and running over the wing. I checked all the instruments, and it was obvious. That engine, if you can believe it, he had an oil tank of 48 gallons of oil. This oil lubricated the engine, but it also circulated engine out of the engine and went through a cooling system and cooled the oil to help cool the engine. And I looked at it, already lost of this 48 gallons of oil, it already lost 20 gallons of oil over a period of 20 minutes or so. Now we got a problem. We're still over enemy territory. Now, if we got a problem, we're going to have to do something with this oil. I estimated figuring out I'd have to feather the prop on that engine in 35 minutes at the rate the oil was going, because if I let it go, it would actually freeze the engine. The engine would run out of oil and be dead. So I would have to, my rule book was, if I had to do this, I had to leave 2 gallons of oil in the tank to run the feathering system. And now here we are. We are 1,700 miles from our home base over open ocean, if we made it out of the area. That was a bad thing to do. If we went to the point that we had to feather the engine, it would have been very difficult to control the airplane with both engines on one side. And we got out of, we did the navigator, before we entered the battlefield, had not had a moonshot or a sunshot. He was not exactly sure where we was at. He had been on what they called dead reckoning, and he felt it very strongly that we had crossed the demarcation line, that we was in friendly territory. And here we are now trying to figure out what to do. And the radio operator, he had been in contact with our primary place of talk to someone was in Iwo Jima. Was I don't know how many thousand miles away, but he was doing it with what he called long wire. He put out a trailing wire antenna and used a telegraph key. And they was actually our control at this time. And we had talked about it then, back and forth with them. We were 7 hours at least flight time and 1,700 miles of open ocean. So what do we do? In a very short period of time, I was going to have to feather that engine while it was still running and stuff. And Hixie, we called him, our radio operator, we was feeding information back and forth to them, and they solved our problem, which was the navigator to ascertain as close as possible his position. And as we got, as he would try and figure 45 minutes away from open ocean. And they advised us to get within 20 to 30 miles from the ocean, because we had secret stuff on the airplane, keep the airplane on autopilot, the autopilot on 1 degree down nose, which would have taken some time to run, which would have actually got us in that period of time over the ocean and crashed in the ocean, which was what we was trying to do. But we bailed out, all of us. We bailed out in a sequence. It was the gunners, the radar operator, the navigator, or no, not the bombardier, the navigator, the radio operator, and me, and the pilot. We just had it strung out. And we all landed okay. A couple of bruised anklets. We landed in some terrain. It was pitch black, nothing we could see. There was no, over Korea, it was an agrarian country. There's no lights at night on anything. And it was an overcast, totally overcast sky. And when we bailed out, we could not see anything. We could not see the ground. We had lowered down to 1,700 feet, over the ground, a navigator at Asserton. That's exactly pretty much where we was at when we bailed out. And when I opened my parachute, this parachute was on, had buckles on it. We didn't wear a parachute. We wore the harness, and it had two D-rings in the front, and we had a balloon packed in front of us with a handle on it, and had two rings, and we could just snap that on the front of us, and that was our parachute. We were always in training advised when we did that, we tucked our, to the right, and tucked our head under our arm, because when we pulled this ring, it came up and it went up, and if we had our head open or something, it would hit us, maybe knock us out. But I didn't know. I did that. I put my head, tucked it under my arm, but I didn't know if I was up, down, or what. I couldn't see. It was about totally black. One circle I went around, I could actually see the lights flashing on the airplane as it was going. But I pulled my ripcord, and apparently I was upside down, because it went off, it hit me on the side of the head and tore my ear halfway off. And I was bleeding all over the place. But all of us landed okay. We had whistles with our stuff. We tried to whistle, and we could. And I contacted one other person. It could have been either the pilot or the radio operator, I know, because one was on either side of me. And we couldn't see anything. We had flashlights. And from training, we just did the best we could. It was 17 below zero, and we had summer uniform, nothing. But we had what we called a B1 bag. It was a zipper bag, quite large, had two handles on it, and in case of bailout, we could take those handles and put them on the straps that went around our waist and our crotch, and that would be between our legs. But all of us had some type of clothes or something like that, and in my particular case, I know I had some socks in there, some underwear, and a shirt from something from another. Put everything we had on, that I had on at least. And had the parachute canopy there, and I had that all on. It was a place where there was brush and a lot of leaves and that, and I raked a pile of leaves up. I had previously wrapped something around my head because I was bleeding around the chin, and I stopped the bleeding. And I scraped these up in a pile, and I was in kind of like a little ditch that kind of fit around me, and put all the leaves in there and all the other stuff I could get, and took the parachute that was still there, wrapped that all around me, and laid down in this stuff and went to sleep. You'd think it'd be hard to do, but it wasn't. I just went to sleep. The next thing I knew, I heard a vehicle, and it was starting to daylight out, and I could see a little bit, and I could see in the distance there was and it's very obviously it was an Army 6x6 truck. And here there was. Hixie had got through somehow before we had to bail out on the long wire, as he called it, and got a position from the navigator, and he pretty much knew where we were at, and they were out looking for us. And it took them, it wasn't hard once they found two of us, because we was all in a line. Now they could go line these up, you could go this way and find people or that way and find people, but we were all lined up, and it was somewhere in the middle, and it took them about 2 hours or so, they actually found us all. And we were pretty cold. And this was an Army replacement depot for people and stuff. They didn't have any much there. But they did have a medic. And he was a corporal, you know, in the military. Corporals are pretty well, you know, a little ways up the rank schedule, but not greatly up there. And he sewed my ear back on as a flap and stopped the bleeding. And it didn't take him long. We all scattered all around, and we got some warmer clothes to wear and what have you. And it took us to an Army base, which is about, I don't know, they said 50 miles away, in these trucks. And all this time we had, and that had a small field hospital in it. Took us all there and patched us up, the guys with the sprained ankles and knees and what have you. And he come to me, the doctor, looked at my ear, and he said, "Who done this job on this guy? Who was it? Where was that? Who did this surgery?" And, well, I couldn't help it. Some guy sewed my ear back on. And I said, "Well, I don't know. All I know is this guy was a corporal in the Army, and he sewed it on." He said, "Well, I'd like to have that guy in my outfit." He says, that's the best sewing job I've ever saw. Because this guy, instead of sewing all the way around, he took little stitches, as this doctor told me, on this side of the wound and turned my ear over on the other side of the wound and did a little bitty stitches all across it, where it didn't squeeze everything together. He said, "And I don't have a scar there. I've never had any problem with that one." But anyway, we got there was an Air Force C-154 was flying from to the south somewhere, and they had a stop. They were building an airfield there that we could have landed on, probably, but there was no place to land if they were in, that was under our territory, could land this big airplane. And they had hauled some lights in for this field. And we talked to the crew, and they said, "Well, where are you heading for from here?" And said, "Well, we were going to get some crew rest and leave in about 8 or 10 hours. And we said, "Hey, look, we got a pilot and we got a co-pilot here that hadn't exceeded their tour times. You guys that got the pilot and the co-pilot and navigator, and we got a navigator, why are we waiting, fella? Let's gas up and head out for Okinawa." And I guess they said, "That sounds like a good idea." So we got the ground crew to gas us up and get us a bunch of flight lunches, and we all hopped on the airplane. And the two pilots and the two co-pilots and that airplane didn't have an engineer station on it, but I helped them then with flying the airplane from just needs that you'd have to do otherwise, and took a couple of naps, and we made it to Okinawa.
Now, was this your closest call on a plane during the Korean War?
No, this was the second. 4 months later, we actually had to ditch an airplane in the North Atlantic. This was in warm times. It was in June It's for January, May, or June. And we run out of gas. And this is my area of responsibility.
You're flying over North Korea.
We was flying back from bombing, from a bombing, or heading back home. And that's my problem. Because I determined in our pre-fight before we left that the tanks were full and the transfer pumps all worked, and that was it. But we had we had 700 gallons in a left. We had actually, when we were going down, we still had 1,500 gallons of gas on the airplane. 700 gallons of gas in each outer wing. And usually the thing was, there was 7 gas tanks in this wing. That was my job. I had to transfer fuel between these tanks to keep us going and burn the fuel. That was, and on my pre-flight, I couldn't dip the tanks, but this was a modern airplane that had fuel tank indicators, what on gauges, and it showed all my tanks were full, and all the pumps were working. And that was basically my responsible to get this airplane flying. Now the ball drops on me. How did this happen? But I couldn't solve the problem. We had to ditch the airplane. And in Old Hixie again, there's 10 people on this airplane, the crew. Hixie was the youngest. The radio operator was 19. I was the second. I was 20 years old. The pilot, the navigators, were somewhere in their mid-20s. They were all from the World War II, still in the service. So we had no other way to do. We were right in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
And was this the same crew that...
We're the same crew. We're
the same crew as you spoke about before.
Same crew.
Do you remember the pilot's name?
I do not know, other than Hicks and a couple. I don't know a lot of their names. I'd be guessing, but.
What happened next?
What happened next? Old Hixie saved us again. The youngest guy. He got in contact. Believe it or not, back in those days, you had the communications. You had big things here and big things and all this. He got in contact with a Japanese submarine that was running on the surface, charging their batteries. And he got together with our navigator with our positions. And we gave those to the submarine, and it turned out that we was about 150 miles apart. And that we had enough gas to make that with no problem. And the two navigators got together on long wire, and we had their exact position. We could fly. It took us only like 30 minutes to get there because we could fly at around 250 miles. An hour. And we got there and we could see all off in the horizon. We could actually see the submarine on the surface. And now they got direct communications between somebody, the captain on there, and our pilot, and got the wind direction and anything. And we did what we were trying to do, how to ditch an airplane. And the seas were smooth, pretty much, and so we ditched and landed just, oh, I don't know, 800 feet away from where we landed, parallel of the way he was running. He turned into the wind for us so that we knew how to. We made a good landing, got out our life rafts and that. We'd go from the inside of the airplane. They were in packets on top of the airplane. You had things that you could pop the doors open and that and get that to the. Got in our little boats, pontoon boats here, or whatever you want to call them, and paddled over to the submarine, and we all got above. They let us go down inside their submarine, and it was really a nice sunny day. We were sitting on the deck, and they'd stopped their engines as they were sitting there, and they weren't in any hurry to go anywhere, apparently. And we just talked back and forth, and some of their crew members come up, and they fed us some food. They had, it was mutton sandwiches. And I can tell you right now, if somebody offers you a mutton sandwich, I would refuse to eat it.
Did they speak English on this Japanese subs?
Yeah. They had most of them, well, because of that international thing, they all spoke some English, and actually, bringing that up, I can't remember. We all had some form of communication, but there was a destroyer. It was called pickup ships between our target and Okinawa. There was two picket ships. It was 1,700 miles, and so it actually could place you anywhere from zero to like 400 miles between one of our destroyers. That we knew that, and Hicks had got involved with all their Navy people, and they knew what was and was heading the A destroyer to where we was at, and. So I don't know, it was about maybe 4 hours before one of them got there, and they really put the foot down, I guess, on the speedometer, and we just all got out and boarded our airplane and waved goodbye to the Japanese. I don't know, I think the destroyer had been on the water for quite a while, was down on food, and so the captain of the destroyer sent a whole bunch of food and stuff over for them where they wouldn't have to eat crackers or something all the time. So we gave them a bunch of food and waved off, and away we went back.
Did you ever figure out what went wrong with this airplane?
Yep, exactly what went wrong with it. There was an inspection on the two wings that held 750 gallon each. They had, depending on the flying time, they had to drain those tanks completely and pressurize them to find any leaks that was in them. And they had done this on it. And at the tanks were opened up, and this was when our airplane was in for a routine inspection, and this was one of them. A young kid, just on the crew, it was his job to seal these tanks, and in the wing he had a gusset of the plate to open up in the wing, and it had the placard on there that says, "This valve should stay open always, open and wired." Well, the pressure right to do it, they closed the valve, and the valve never got reopened. And they figured this all out. And I do know that the young kid that caused the problem was okay. No problem.
He wasn't charged for a B-29?
No. But the guy, the next guy in line who was supposed to inspect his work was. And I don't even know in wartime. I think they restricted him to the base for 3 months and charged him a $200 fine or something. But then his boss, which was an officer, got whacked really bad. But this kid just, hey, you guys didn't help your friend there. So our commander decides we've had enough. They had just finished a B-24 bomber. It was a bomber, and they had put this in the Japanese. It was a Japanese factory, airplane factory had been bombed, but had a lot of experts in there. And they had taken this airplane because of flying. Commander wanted to go from here to there, he had to take an airplane with the guns on it and all this. Well, they had put this thing in some type of a situation with these Japanese people come in and took all the gun turrets away from them, closed them up mostly, and put windows in it. And all the military airplanes didn't have no insulation on the inside, put insulation inside of it. And they were going to use this for an egg run, they call it, hauling people from one place to another. And he says, hey, I got this, the right crew, that's yours. But the problem was, we had to split up. We didn't have any gunners. We didn't have a radar operator on there. We didn't have a bombardier. Of the 10 of us, five of them was out of a job. But the rest of us flew this all up and down. We went clear down to the Philippines and back to Holland VIPs. And we were on our own, five of them. And Hixie was actually the coordinator, you know, picked this guy up here at this time. And we did, I was there, that finished me up. Was 5 months that finished my tour up on that airplane. And we were really good. We had five, some of these spots trying to do something. When we got down where it was really warm, we'd just get up on the airplane wing and with a blanket and a pillow and sleep, or somewhere in the airplane or on there. We never ever checked in because we were on the go all the time. And I had really a hard job. I was by myself with all the mechanical stuff on there, no work docks or anything. And I got my final way of doing things in an emergency, because there was always one. This airplane had the starters on this airplane. The engine was bad. It was bad from design, and it would go wrong. Something would happen to it. Usually, it had a clutch on it that went out, and you were dead until you got another starter. And it was phasing the airplane out. We had to do this. We had one time, we was carrying a 4-star general, but he had a C-54 that was built for him, but his outfit had one of these B-24s that we had. It was converted, and we tried to get a starter from them, and they were out of other than what they had on their airplanes. They had them, we were carrying this guy someplace. And so we said, listen, General, we can't go. He says, yes, he can. And he got the maintenance officer over and says, take that starter off of that airplane and put it on this airplane.
He was a four-star general.
Four-star general, that's right. And we did. And a lot of times we really broke the rules bad. I remember another time we had a four-star general and there was no B-24s. There was no, and the damn starter went out. And here we can't start one in. It was a number three engine. It was a good engine to have to go out. And so we talked it over, the crew, and there was a way of doing it. We could actually start this engine by flying the airplane. So we talked this over, and we had 17 passengers. Had their stuff lined up, bags and everything. And we said, okay, my pilot and I together and sat and talked about this. And there was a situation where you could actually on a multi-engine aircraft, four engines, that was the only size you could use. We could windmill it. And so we agreed, and we had a general on here, and nothing he could do this time. And we said, General, if we can unload all your people and all your stuff on this airplane, take it off, and any other thing we could do, we had a full gallon of gas. That was the problem. We can make this. And they did. And so the pilot and I got in the pilot seat, in the co-pilot seat, and had control of all the engines and what have you from him. And we got them all started up. The three, we feathered the one that had the bad starter. I could feather that easy enough with the controls on the ground. And the two of us went out and got on the end of the runway. And I said, okay, you tell me, you can see the airspeed indicator. You tell me when we hit 70 knots. And I'm going to start bringing this propeller out of feather. And we did it. I started it out. I knew that at 1700 RPM and manifold pressure of 14, it was like acted like a dead engine as this. And I had to stop it after it was started. Easy, just let it run and it'll warm up. That's very critical with these radio engines. And actually, by the time we got about halfway around the landing circle, the engine has gotten warm. I brought it up on power. And we landed, taxied over to where everybody was out, had people stationed around where they couldn't walk into a propeller or something, and got everything loaded up again, and away we went. That airplane, of all things, was going to Vietnam.
Really?
At that time, Vietnam, that was a stop. The next stop was Australia, of course.
And this was not by the rule book?
Not by the rule book, no. It was frowned on by the rule book. But it worked for us. But we would have, if something would have happened on one of those other three engines, we would have been in it, as they call it, the old poo-poo.
So you flew on planes during basically the entire Korean War.
Yeah.
You flew on combat missions. Mm. You flew transporting people from here to there.
Yes.
How did you end up in Alaska?
Well, in Alaska, it was after this war was over and what have you, and in between. I was stationed actually in California at the time, and was flying large cargo aircrafts, and that was getting kind of monotonous. And at this time, I had married and had a daughter that was she was 5 years old, and I don't know, we thought down. Sat down one evening, I guess, after our meal and said, you know, and I was right on the borderline. I could volunteer for a new position.
And you're still in the Air Force at this time?
Still in the Air Force.
Yes.
And so remind. I actually went over in the personnel people and looked for places where maybe would have openings. And lo and behold, one of them was Alaska with a air rescue unit. And we talked it over, the family had said, let's go. So I put in for it, and I had the background of Fort, and we went to Alaska.
What were your first impressions of Alaska?
Cold. No, it was... Well, Alaska, yeah, you think of it as cold, and certainly it is at times of the year, it's very cold. But you dress for this, and you know that, and you don't try and violate that rule because it's very likely going to kill you. And so, yeah, it was so good I extended it. It was a three-year billet, and I extended it 4 years. So we were there 4 years.
What city were you based out of?
We were based in Anchorage at the Air Force. There was two Air Force bases, one in Anchorage and one in the other big town.
How many years did you serve in the rescue team?
That rescue team? 4 years.
Four years.
We did an average of probably somewhere close to 300 rescues a year of some various kind. They could be from land, from water, from wherever.
What 4 years were these? Was this the 19?
These would have been, Linda was born in 1950 and she was four. It was been about 1950.
1954 until 1958 or so was your time
of
service.
Yeah.
Who did you meet of interest as you were serving during your rescue squad years? Did you find a mentor, somebody to take you under their wing?
You had probably a very short period of time, maybe weeks or so. And you were just, you simply were on your own. And I was an engineer, mm-hmm. but not the type that sat down at a bunch of controls to control the engines. And that was a smaller type airplane. And my problem was this, any mechanical problem that come up when we was flying on missions, on controls, something happened, a battery would go bad, how to do this, how to do that. Probably you learned on your own. Something was different. Sometimes you had a rescue of somebody. There was no way of getting there. The airplane that we used at that time was called a Grumman. Airplane that landed on the land, sea, or snow and ice, but not any snow and ice. It would have to be a lake or something.
You didn't fly planes ever, did you?
No, I never did, although I do still have a pilot's license, but not for the Air Force. I had a pilot's license when I went into the Air Force and was drafted, but still it wasn't good enough because there was taking all the pilots and everything, they was dumping them out of the Air Force. They wasn't training anybody at all. And I don't know, I kind of like that. I think I lived other than pay. I love my job better than I would have if I'd have been a pilot or a co-pilot or what have you.
So to get your license, you, I imagine, had to fly planes and practice runs, yeah. But you never actually, after you got your license, flew as a pilot.
I had a license, but it was the first stage of learning to fly an airplane. I could have flown an airplane in itself. I could not, at the rating I had at that time, I could not take a passenger. So only I had something like 70 hours of flying time. And I never took that up.
You never flew on your own?
No.
So in 1958, you finished up your term of service with the emergency crews. What did you do then?
You know, we come back to the United States, and we were stationed Michigan, in Selfridgeville, Michigan, just north of Detroit. It was on the lake there.
You were still with the Air Force?
Still in the Air Force, yeah. And still there, and that was kind of... Linda was they had an excellent school system and what have you, and Linda was getting impatient to move, and my daughter, and it was close to Detroit, and we just didn't, none of us was really happy with it. So here again, I go into this, the Air Force has this system you can do. You can change careers if they associate with one another. And I went down into the people that did this and said, well, if I wanted to volunteer for another assignment, and I'd been there in Detroit, the amount which was 2 years, the Air Force wouldn't move you any sooner than that. But I could do it. I could stay for another 2 years normally. But anyway, what popped up in my mind, a billet at the American Embassy in Bonn, Germany.
Now, Ken, tell me, did you ever return then to Alaska, or was your 4 years from 1954 to 58 your exclusive time in Alaska?
Yeah, did I ever return to Alaska?
Did you ever go back to Alaska after 1958 then, in the Air Force?
Not in the Air Force, but Margie and I went back to Alaska at one time.
Well, during those 4 years, let me ask you a bit about meeting Bishop William Gordon, the Flying Bishop of Alaska. How did you meet, and what was your relationship like?
Gordon... he was the Bishop of Alaska, of course, and he had an airplane. He had his pilot's license, and he was a bush pilot, what they call him at that time. Now, I was in this rescue unit, so we had some kind of association with that. We had, there was a lot of times where he would get in trouble. He had his airplane. As a matter of fact, I did the maintenance on his airplane. And so we talked together a lot and had things, and something would happen, and I stole gasoline for him. And we had, he made this circuit off to all of these villages and that. And every one of these little airstrips, they were all unpaved airstrips. The airplane that we were flying was built for that kind of stuff too. And every one of these, somewhere towards the end of the airstrip, somewhere where it was out a little bit, he had something that looked like an outhouse there. And it was open, the door. And he would fly around and forget where he was at sometimes, and had no, and was out of gas. But in these little houses, there was just a little thing, as a prefab thing. He kept usually 2 5-gallon gallons of gas in there, and it wasn't locked up. Other pilots flew in there and they'd use these gas, but they would, believe it or not, there's the most honest people in the world, the last bush pilot. They would replace his gas if they ever had to use it in an emergency. And actually, when we were around there, by violations, I used to carry 10 gallons of gas back in the back of this airplane where nobody actually noticed it. It was in tins. You could buy, they threw them away outside, but you could reseal them. And if I knew we was going to go to one of these little fields, I would drain off one of our, 1,700 gallon of gas in our airplane and fill it up. Everybody knew I was aware of this. And we'd fill up these gas cans if they were empty, or if they wouldn't, we wouldn't. But always, we'd practice landings there at these places, and we'd always stop long enough. I'd go over and look at this little hut and see if they had an empty gas can in there. And I had a spigot on our airplane on the side. We could fill up his gas can.
You were using United States taxpayer dollars to fund the work of the Episcopal Church in Alaska.
That is correct. That's exactly correct.
What was Bishop Gordon like as a person?
He was a nice guy. He's a really, I mean, I used to call him and say, "Hey, Bish." He was okay with that.
He was down to earth.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, did you take some instruction from him in the Episcopal faith at some point?
No, I didn't. As a matter of fact, I was not an Episcopal. I was not a Lutheran. I was Episcopalian at the time. No, I never did. He never pushed forward or what have you.
You talked about being a deacon and delivering communion.
Yeah.
Is that in relation to Bishop Gordon?
That was.
Tell me about that, Ken.
Well, that's, we just, back in those days, I guess probably, somehow, that's how I did get into the Lutheran Church.
Episcopal faith.
Yeah. Somehow, I mean, we actually went to, this goes back so far.
When you met Bishop Gordon, you were already an Episcopalian.
I was an Episcopalian, Episcopalian.
And when he found it out, did he ask you, "Hey, can you be part of my team and be an approved deacon to deliver communion"?
He did do that, yes.
He asked you, what did you say?
I said, yes, I would. And I did do that. Because there was no one else around. And the fact that at one time we always went into these villages. Now, in my own agency there, I had in conjunction with him, I had our shop make some little cans. And on each airplane, I had secreted one of those in there. It was consecrated wine. And we flew in all these villages around. There was just no way he could keep these up, flying airplane and did it. And I kept them there, and he got me a smock and hat to build the business, and I gave him communion. But I don't know how he got around this. It's the fact that it had been consecrated. I was just a delivery man, I suppose you'd say. And I would do that in these villages.
So this is during your official duties in the Air Force. You'd be at a village or a place with an Episcopal church.
Yeah.
And during your spare time, you'd visit the church and say, hey, I brought communion from the bishop. Would anyone like to receive it? I'd be happy to serve.
Yeah, exactly.
I see. And this consecrated communion would be held in special boxes, you say?
It was a tin box, so it wouldn't break or something. And I had our maintenance shops, the tinners, and that made a special thing. And he would consecrate this, and I had it, and it was kind of in a secret place on the. I shifted airplanes all the time, but I had four of these on, but we had six airplanes. But I tried to get the airplane that was going to one of the villages that had services with the church, but
no priest.
No priest. But there was one priest. I can't remember. He's a young man, and he had a family, two children. And he was in he was not in Anchorage, remember. He was out in the field in Kublakok, I think, somewhere. It was a pretty big village. And they gave him a log cabin, a pile of wood, three dogs, and a salmon rack. And they were on their own. And I think they had two children, was in something like 2 and 5 or something when that happened.
What type of plane did the bishop have?
It was a Cessna, four seats, had a little 120 horsepower engine.
What were the challenges of working on those type of planes?
They were very simple airplanes. They just had some basic rules, and if you followed them, you had no problem with them. They all had inspection times that had to be done on time and accurate, but they were very reliable. It was a Cessna 170 and tail dragger, but I never really had a whole lot of contact with him other than this. Sometimes we meet, or we was picking somebody up somewhere, and he would be there, and we would talk. And he was a nice man, very, very sociable. He's the type of guy you just like from the beginning. He was just a real nice fellow.
Yeah. Did you consider him a skilled pilot?
Yes, absolutely. He had not crashed any airplanes in Alaska, and that was great. That never happened. I mean, it was all rough gravel airstrips. The worst thing you could land an airplane on. No, I never. I actually had an FAA license at that time, where I could certify maintenance on any U.S. aircraft anywhere in the world. I still have that, and I did his annuals for him, and
during your 4 years,
yeah, if it come up, there was only and during that period of time. It was, yeah, four times, because the annual was due every year.
Did you ever have to make parts on your own out in the bush for a plane?
Well, for the Air Force, I did a lot of times, but I don't think I did with the Bishop. That I can remember. He was a good pilot. He had no problem with that. Did a lot of flying. I can't think of anything. One time, I think the only time in all those years, he had a flat tire. And I don't know how. I knew the tire, and I knew what it looked like. And I can't think of the circumstances, but I got a tire mounted on a rim, and I was a beggar there for a lot of things, for our things, for the military. I guess I always stole something from the Air Force. But it come from something or something. And I had one of the crews at one time was going by this village drop this off. And I don't know how he got it put on, but it wouldn't be hard to do. I mean, three or four people could just push up on the wing and you could take it off and something. But I never, at the times I saw him, I never come up in a conversation of where it, but there was some things he used to do there that really helped him out. He had a hard time. He had a just faith and what have you was not there in Alaska. I mean, people just had hard times, and but they were honest people. And
what do you mean that people had hard times?
Well, it's just the life, the cold weather. You dared not fool with the weather in Alaska. You did not say, "Oh, I'm going to go here and take this little trip here, and I won't miss take this with me or that with me." Well, that was fool's thinking, because when something happened, you were probably dead.
You had to respect the weather.
Oh, you had to expect the weather. Definitely, you had to expect the weather.
Did Bishop Gordon respect the weather?
Well, it didn't kill him. It didn't kill him for sure. So.
Well, Ken, tell me about, remember during your rescue time, during your time, you know, knowing Bishop Gordon, you had a rather memorable Christmas Eve rescue.
Yes.
Remember that? Can
yes.
you share that story?
Yeah. You want to share that?
No, please.
Oh. Well, it was at Christmas time. And, of course, we were on alert, this rescue outfit, 24 hours a day, just I don't know, just day after day after day. Well, at Christmas, all of us, I was a manager of engineers, and had the pilots had them, and the parachute jumpers had those. And radar operators, those, the head of those units, all, we formed ourselves as a crew, at which would be the same as the regular crews in ability to do their jobs. So we on Christmas, our day in the normal service would be eight. Your tour of duty was 8 in the morning until 8 the following morning, 24 hours. So we took whoever was on those days, we took their place so they could be with their family. And like it is, things happen. It was from Fairbanks to Anchorage was a doctor, and he had his wife and three kids. It was a dual-engine Cessna airplane. And he was flying from Fairbanks to, and the engine acted up on him. And he could fly and stabilize the airplane and fly it. And he went on alert on the A-Day, and we knew this was happening in mission control. And we knew he was by a lake called Long Lake. And we said that the lake is frozen over. It's probably got a foot or so of snow on it. But right now, that's your salvation, is to land on that lake. And he did. And it worked out fine. And
this is on a flight from Fairbanks to Anchorage?
Yeah. But we scrambled our crew. And we kind of got there, actually, about the same time. And we jumped and we asked him to try and hold the airplane steady enough to make one circle around the lake. And we jumped our parachute guys, paramedics, and they landed, and they said the lake was okay, the snow was minimal, was only about a foot. And so then we advised the pilot to land there. And actually, we landed ourselves on there right afterwards. And our airplane was designed for it. His wasn't. And it looked okay. He didn't have any. He landed gear up, and the snow balanced everything, neither one of the props got damaged. And then actually a day later they flew it out. But when we picked them up, and they had somebody going for it. But I could tell him exactly what he did wrong to get in the position he was in. Because as I walked around the airplane, I looked at water dripping out of the Cali and the airplane, and what had happened, and it is a very critical thing in Alaska. He did not use carburetor heat. I looked in his cockpit, and he did not have it on, and he iced up the carburetor, and wasn't enough that the engine kept running, but not very good. And I know when we landed, I walked out. I water was dripping there. The heat from the engine was melting the ice around the carburetor. That's all they needed to do. They had to take some airbags up and lifted it up, but it didn't, because of the heat and the ice. It actually done just practically no damage to the airplane, and the props actually stopped running it in a horizontal position. It was a two-bladed prop. So yeah, they flew it right out with no problems.
Now, was there another occasion when a woman was giving birth in a remote village on Christmas Eve?
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell that story, Ken?
Oh, yeah, that was a story. As a matter of fact, that, again, was one of these things. It was on Christmas. Mm. Again, and this
is another Christmas.
Another Christmas. Mm-hmm. And we were doing the same thing. And this lady actually was giving birth, and she had the village had a midwife, But it just got over her head. She couldn't handle the problem. And so they called in for a board emergency.
Do you remember where this village was?
It was close to not, it was on the eastern border. I think it was very close to Nome, but Unibek, if I remember. I just don't remember. But it had a primitive runway was a problem. Mm-hmm. And this, again, was snow and ice, and they had shoveled that off. And this airplane we used was a tough airplane. And we got the call, and we went, The biggest thing about this whole thing was that we did not have a doctor with us. Mm-hmm. Because the doctor who was supposed to be on call had drank at a party.
And you're in Anchorage, Alaska, right? This is where your base is. Yeah. And the doctor on call was at a party, and he was inebriated. Yeah.
He was inebriated. And they tried to find another doctor because everybody is celebrating. And actually, our paramedic, they were pretty close to certified nurses. But the oldest one guy, and he was getting ready to retire, he himself had assisted in something like a dozen births and had done two or three himself. And we were sitting on the end of the runway. We were ready to launch, waiting for this doctor who was drunk. And pretty soon the controller knew all of us, and he says, "Who's your paramedics?" We carried two paramedics. And we told him his name, which is John McGovern. And he said, "John McGovern." And we, when they heard that, we was listening on the phone, they said, "Launch." So we went with John. And we got there, and the woman was in some real pain. And John had went through, like I said, quite a few of these things. And it wasn't long. We was all trying to help him, heating up water and come in and what have you. And he got the job done. And I'll tell you, when this kid come out, I'll tell you, you'd think all this has been going on for over 24 hours with the pain, that this kid would be dead or something. And when she, as a girl, when she came out, you could hear her in Anchorage, Alaska. She was ready to get out of there. And we got her settled down. John had us all running around. And we had some flight lunches with us, had some milk in them. We heated it up. He used a syringe and gave her a little milk, and she settled down enough that I wrapped her up. I had a flight jacket and what have you, and took her up to the front with the pilot and co-pilot and showed him up there, and she was just had settled down, and the mother. John gave her a shot of something, and it wasn't 30 minutes till she was out. And
this is a Native American Alaskan family.
Yeah.
Was the father there at the time?
The father was there. The whole family was there with her. Mm-hmm. But they did have a midwife, but she just had got... She couldn't handle it. She didn't know. And John, if it hadn't been for John and his experience, he probably couldn't have, but he had experienced a couple of these things in these 30 years of service.
Trouble bursts.
Yeah. So that worked out okay. And when we got to Anchorage, we landed on the airplane and taxied up. And it looked like half of the world was there. The newspaper was out. The people there was out taking, you know, and we just had to say, hey, get back. We opened the hangar doors and pushed the airplane in and closed them. We had to get, I mean, you know, everybody in Anchorage was there.
It made the papers the next day?
It made the papers, yeah. Huh?
And what was the child called? Do you remember what name the mother gave the child?
Yes, it was Carolyn, for some reason or another. Mm-hmm. That was her name, Carolyn. Yeah, she said, but her mother never did wake up. We had her on a stretcher and took her on. She was out after 2 days of this. She was just, but it turned out she was, didn't hurt her any, wasn't causing any bad falls.
You left the baby with the father and the family as you made your way back.
They took them. Anchorage had a native hospital. Mm-hmm. They took them right to the hospital after we had there.
They took the baby to the hospital. The
baby and the mother.
And the mother went to the hospital on the plane.
And they took her to the hospital, I guess, for checking her over after this and whatever had to do, and the baby, checking the baby over. But then,
And this took place the evening of December 24th.
That's correct, yeah.
Were there any other, Ken, memorable rescues that you look back on?
I guess there was so many of them every day, and some of them, many, many of them was tragic. Mm. These were people who we had to go in and pick from aircraft, actually bush pilots who violated the rules and what have you, would go in. I don't know how many people I put in body bags, the crew, all of us picking up pieces and what have you.
So you were on a number of recovery missions where you were recovering bodies from bush pilots who had crashed. And their passengers.
But not only that, but just people who were in trouble and getting them out of trouble and things. But a lot of them were crashes, airplane crashes and what have you. And Alaska, they had, it was still, I don't know, it was still somehow under control of the federal government, and you had certain things that you could do that was not normally done by the natives themselves, and never caused a problem, but always problem that you had to, in a lot of cases, you had to build a new solution to them when the next one come on in like that. It was always something very, very bad. We used to have to go on strip alert up in the very tip of Alaska. We would fly up there, and we had to our airplanes, they had outside, we had to stay there, and there was something called it was a national weather station right at Point Barrow, and it had an airstrip, and we would have to go and spend, because it was so cold there, our airplane, and we'd be there for like 3 days at a time, just sitting there. We never knew why we did that. But we had to, our airplane, we had to every 3 hours around the clock. We had no cover for it. We had to run the engines. We'd never got them started otherwise. And we found out later that this was caused because, I don't know if you ever heard of this V1 accident where this guy got shot down in this high-flying airplane over Russia. U-2 it was called. Well, it landed and flies somewhere in Bergen, in Northern Europe, across the pole and land in Northern Alaska at the tip. And that's what we were waiting for. It was all top secret. We had no idea why we was there. The only person that knew was the pilot. And
so you were hanging out in Point Barrow, Alaska, on the northern tip of Alaska, looking for this spy plane.
Well, waiting for him to go across and land, that he didn't get shot down in the way going or something. But we did that several times. And we never knew that. It was actually years later that something just come up that I even knew why we were doing that. But yeah, it was something. Well, we had crew. The pilot would team up with a paramedic, and the navigator team up with a navigator. And I don't know. We had I paired up with the doctor. We had four people who could start the airplane up and warm it up. It'd take us about an hour to get it warm. And then we diluted the oil as the engine was running. We pumped gasoline into the oil to thin it. And then every time we started it up, we had to run it at idle until the heat evaporated the gas out of the oil. It was a kind of complicated thing. I can imagine that happened maybe 5 or 6 times. It was.
What were the approximate temperatures while you were hanging out in Point Barrow?
We're talking about below zero, down 20, 30 below zero. I mean, cold.
Did you ever come across polar bears during your time there in Alaska?
A lot of them by air, but never on the ground. Never came across one. As you're flying up in the northern part, you could always look down and find polar bears. Well, not always, but frequently find polar bears a lot, you know. Yeah.
Ken, what are your most vivid memories of Alaska?
It's hard to say. There's a lot of humanitarian entered into the picture. I mean, you were genuinely helping somebody. You were genuinely saving somebody's life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't helping them, it was saving their lives. And that sticks with you. A long, long time. Mm-hmm. And I know the little one-on-one conversation I've had with Bishop Gordon, it affected him very much, because he was in the midst of his parish. And he did make his rounds he had no helper. He did later on got a guy that come in that was just finished all of his training and had a family, and there was two of them. But the parish itself was it was I don't know. I'd say '70 or '80, something like that. 90.
His parish was all of Alaska, all the territory of Alaska.
Yes. Yes, all of Alaska, and that was. I'm talking about the home parish there, not
in Anchorage.
Yeah,
in a parish with some 70 to 80 members. Yeah.
But the, I guess you'd have to say all these villages that was something else. I know the two of us that we gave communion to the villages. Everything was done. We'd say pass it out. We had a mitre and a coat, but we wasn't sure. You know, the villages, they had maybe 20 people in this village, maybe 30 people in the village, and so many kids, and they had a little like a village place where they went in. They had their churches. And it was, you know, it was a faith type thing. You know, we didn't on Sundays and that you had your own church. You didn't have a pastor, or there was no trained pastors in the time I was there. And I don't.
You and the bishop would serve communion together. You'd do some services with him. Or is this
no,
all
I never
on your
did.
Own? You never did a service with him.
No, other than church, you know. I never did any services, and none of that.
So you would serve communion on your own, yeah. And then he would serve communion on his own.
Yeah,
but you didn't have like joint activities that you did together.
No, didn't. It was just too many people, too much scattered, and when we gave them communion, so to speak, they had a little pole stretched across there. They had nobody. That didn't matter. This 2-year-old boy there, give him communion. we just went down the line, you know. Little girl here, yeah, we'd let her touch her lips on the thing, and everybody got communion. It was pretty primitive. Mm. Pretty primitive.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Ken, you'd like to add that we haven't covered about your time in Alaska?
That's about it, I think.
Well, Ken, reflecting on your experiences, do you have any advice for young people?
I think young people in this day and age, I don't think they understand Christianity at all. I really don't. The way they act, the way they rings in their noses, this, you know. I'm sure none of them has a church. I personally, Margie made it, I personally don't know anyone that I'm associated with from day to day, a church member. Now, Joyce here is a very, I don't know what her affiliate is, but she's a Christian. You can tell her. She helps us. We sing Christian songs or something on Sunday and what have you. I think she is. I'm not sure about her children. They don't hear anything about, but I do know she does belong to a church and is active in it. I don't know what his name is, but you run into people have no idea what it is to set in a church.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ken, let me ask you, I didn't address this earlier, but you said you went back to Alaska years later, and had Alaska changed. Can you tell me about your visit to Alaska?
The last time, oh yes, it had changed. It had been 40 years. It had been. When we were there, Anchorage went out to 21st Street. 40 years later, Anchorage went out to 97th Street in that period of time. So it was a change. When we went into Anchorage, into the town, the village, to shop and that from our Air Force base, we had to go across a little river coming down from the mountains. It was called Ship's Creek. And it had, even in your car, it had a wooden trestle. You'd drive across there and going across back and forth in this lake under there. Well, when we come back, that's the biggest surprise forever. Now it's got a big concrete bridge across there, these big ramps going around, this going up in there and this going up in the air. Yeah, it had changed immensely from when I'd been there. And I know Linda, and I thought about this the other day. She's coming down in January, coming up from Texas.
Linda, your daughter? Sure.
My daughter. And we would go down at night, and this Ship Creek was crossed. It was went through the Air Force Base, and it was our house there. We had about a 3 or 4 minute walk down to the creek, and we took a couple of pie pans out of the kitchen. And we went down in sometime in the summer or something to do, and panned for gold. And we had an aspirin bottle about that big around and about that high of gold chips. You had panned it ourselves. And I thought about it, and I don't know where that's at. That's got lost somewhere, or she may have it somewhere. I made a note to ask her about that. But yeah, we panned for in the evening after we'd have dinner. For this time, we'd take pie pans.
And you found significant amounts of it.
Yeah.
Well, Ken, tell me about your land purchase in Alaska. Remember you said somebody panned off some land on you one day, desperate to sell. Tell that story.
Well, he didn't. I guess I panned it off on him. I was there. I can't remember the numbers so much anymore. I bought 40 acres of land, and I paid $1,000 for this guy who was shipping out. He had built just a little cabin on it, and it was up on the side of the mountain, but there was a rough road that went to it. You could drive it for 40 acres.
Approximately, where was this piece of property?
Pardon?
Where was this piece of property located?
Well, it was not in the Anchorage itself, it was about 7 or 8 miles away. But Anchorage is kind of set in a valley, and it was up on the side of the valley. But they had a couple roads back through, but you had to have a jeep to get through them. And it was just up on the side of there and had this little thing, and it had a nice stream coming through it from the ice was melting on the mountain. Nice, clear water. And we used to go out when we had time on weekends, to spend the weekends up there taking a lot of stuff, and had an old wood-burning stove in it to keep warm if it got cold. And it was just pretty crude and rude, but it was just something to get out and do something. And there's moose always around. You had to be very careful of. And there's time to ship out, and I've got this 40 acres of land. And boy, now I got to sell this. And it turns out he had a navigator coming in, and he had 4 kids. They was all pretty. I think the oldest one was something like 10 or 11 and younger. And he wanted something like this. So I took him up and looked at it, and he really liked it. And I had done some modifications to it, built some things, some old things, some things to keep wood in, and had some tools up there, some old axes. He said, "Well, how much do you want for this thing?" And I said, "Well, you know, stuff is high here. I guess I'll $3,000. I'd only paid $1,000 for it." And he said, "Gee, I got kids. I got no. And ultimately, we settled for $1,500. So I figured that was my biggest, my biggest dealings in buildings and what have you in my life. I made $500 on this building. I don't know, I've heard from people later, he really built it over somewhat. But the biggest thing, Margie and I, 40 years later, went up there. And there's something, you'll see it advertised, called Mount Alaska. A big summer vacation land, skiing and what have you on the side of this mountain, world famous out there. And I go down and we look down, they got a big 4-lane highway driving up there, right through this place that we owned there, and get up there and all this whole hillside is divided into 1-acre plots. People coming from Seattle and all over flying up here for the ski. Right in the middle of where I had this plot. And they're selling for something like $60,000, $70,000 for, I think, a 1/4 acre lot. Can you imagine? I'd have been a millionaire.
Is it fair to say you regret getting up on this property so early?
That is right. In fact, 40 years, I don't know. Yeah, that's my biggest regret.
Well, Ken, thanks so much for sharing some of your memories of Alaska.
Yeah, it was fun. Next time we'll talk about